Hey, you're listening to the Self-Hostcast, a podcast dedicated to all things self-hosted. Today, I'm sitting down with Ivan, the developer of the vehicle maintenance tracking application Lublogger. Thanks for listening. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the Self-Hostcast. My name is Ethan, and today I'm joined by Ivan, the developer of the vehicle maintenance tracking app Lublogger. Ivan, thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, man, it's great to be here.
For those who listening who aren't familiar with Lublogger, would you mind starting by just sharing a little bit about what it is and what it does?
Lublogger is kind of like a self-hosted alternative to apps like CarBuddy and stuff like that, where you can record all of your vehicle expenses, you can track your fuel mileage, keep track of all the supplies and stuff like that you've purchased for your car, and all the to-dos, work that you need to do on your cars, repairs, all that kind of stuff. It's kind of like a journal for your vehicle, basically.
I have probably a million questions for you about Lublogger today, but I usually try to start with a bit of an icebreaker, and I feel like it's a bit of an obvious one with Lublogger, and that is the name of the software itself. I remember a few months ago when you posted on Reddit announcing Lublogger, there were some, I think the top comment was something snarky about how great it looked, but they were misled about what maybe the software was intended to be used for.
Yeah, so the name, the name for that app. Initially, I just started with something really generic like car care tracker, but then I'm just like, no, that's too generic, man. Like, everyone's going to think it's a description of an app and not the actual name itself. And what I did was I went on an AI generating website, you know, like just a business name generator website. And I just basically told them that I was like, I'm making an app. It logs all kinds of stuff about vehicles, like, you know, lubrication and all that kind of stuff. And Lublogger was one of the names that popped up. And when I first saw it, I actually chuckled a little bit because I was like, oh, man, like that's something people are going to remember for sure. And I just took it and ran with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you hit it out of the park as far as recognition goes. I don't think people will ever forget what Lublogger is once they've heard it for the first time. And it's one of those things that when you hear it at first and you don't know what it is, you know, it's easy to be slightly taken aback. But once you learn what it is pretty obvious, you know, like, oh, hey, you know, that makes sense. It's for cars and tracking everything related to cars.
I mean, if Jiffy Lube can get away with it, you know, there's like no reason why Lublogger can't.
Yeah, that's fair. I hadn't even thought of that, to be honest. That's a good point. So with all that being said, are you in your spare time or in your non-development or non-software time, are you a car guy? Is that where this came from? Or where'd you come up with the idea for Lublogger?
I mean, I got into like working on cars a couple of years back. I think it was near the beginning of the pandemic. I was just starting out, graduated from college and finally got my first adult job. And, you know, the pandemic happened, the lockdown happened, and I just suddenly find myself having a bunch of time on my hand. And what I did was I went to KSL, which is the Utah equivalent of basically Craigslist. And I just bought a really cheap car. I just sorted price low to high and just bought the first thing I found. And it was a $500 1992 Jeep Cherokee. That thing was a piece of work, really. And I took it home and I just started making like a whole to-do list on what to do to that car. At the time, I didn't have quite the idea for Lublogger quite yet. And so I kind of have everything written in an Excel sheet back in 2020. And over the years, I've done so much work on that thing that now when I go and look at the Excel sheet, it's like almost 500 lines long, and it was just insane.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was insane. I have no way of like categorizing where the expenses and stuff like that. So one day I was just taking a shower and one of those shower dots, you know, and I came out of the shower and I told my girlfriend, I was like, I've got an idea. I'm going to build an app that does this. And at the time, I had no idea that there were like existing apps like this that were in the SaaS, you know, the software as a service model, like CarBuddy. You know, the more I look into it, with the SaaS models, with the cloud apps, they were just so expensive. They were just, you know, they were charging people if they wanted to have more than one car. With the apps on the App Store, the reviews were just really bad because a lot of them, you know, they had cloud storage, and sometimes the developers just couldn't afford to keep that storage or development work going. And so I just looked at it. I was like, there is no good alternative to this. So I'm going to go build one.
I have a couple questions. There's a lot of interesting information in what you just shared. I feel like my first takeaway was, and maybe this isn't worth spending a lot of time on, because I do want to keep the rating PG on this podcast, but it sounds like you're confirming you came up with the idea for Lublogger while you were in the shower.
Yeah.
And the second one, question for you, are you one of those people who tracks everything in your life, or is it really just for this specific project that you had taken on during COVID?
At one point, I was one of those people who kind of tracks, like, you know, compared to everything in life. I used to have a little accounting software that I wrote 10, 12 years ago. And that's what I used to kind of keep track of all my finances, all my cash flows and stuff like that. Like, I keep track on that stuff a lot. But nowadays, you know, I've kind of gone to a point in life where I'm just like, I set up autopay, I've stopped caring. But nowadays, it's just mostly for my vehicles and stuff like that.
That's fair. I'm asking because I feel like that describes myself a little bit. And I wonder, or I often wonder, how prevalent that is in the self-hosted community. I myself am a very organized person. And so I inevitably end up tracking a lot of stuff in Google Docs or something that really isn't meant to be tracking some of these things. Part of the appeal of self-hosting for me is it often gives me an outlet to track some of these things that I wouldn't otherwise have something. And so when I see something like Lublogger, I didn't know I needed that, but I really need that in my life. And so I install it and it's like, wow, now I have this really nice organized place to track these things about my vehicles and I can stay on top of things. This isn't the only area of my life where I do that. And so I'm always curious, is that a tendency of people who self-host? Because it gives us not only more control of our information from the perspective of privacy and big tech and whatnot, but simply because we have this desire for organization and structure that maybe we might not get elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I kind of wonder a lot about, too. I mean, I have a degree in accounting, so that pretty much explains a lot about me liking to keep track of stuff.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder that as well with people who use, I can't remember what that budgeting app was called. There was quite a few of them that were posted on the self-host subreddit. I believe there's a lot of people out there who just wants to like be able to analyze, you know, different aspects of their life at a time. I think that's what draws a lot of people to self-hosting. In general, yeah.
I feel like I see so many conversations about dashboards and all the applications that will log and chart system stats. And it just leads to me to believe that that's probably more true than not, I would think. With Lublogger, it's funny. I went back, as I was prepping for this conversation, I went back and made sure I was just familiar with the life cycle of Lublogger so far. And I remember you hadn't announced it too long ago. And so I went back and on your GitHub, the releases, the first one was like January 4th or something of this year. So it sounds like you were probably working over the holidays on Lublogger during your time off. You've released a lot of updates since then. So you're clearly spending a lot of time and investing time into developing this. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I actually spent a lot of time building like side projects and all of that stuff in the winter, because I'm not sure where you live, but I live in a part of the country that is just gets brutal winters. Like, I live in the Utah desert and we get like 2 or 3 feet of snow, just absolutely hammered by snow every winter. And that lasts about 5 to 6 months. During that period of time, there's just not a whole lot of places that I can go or do anything really. So mainly I just sit at home and just start thinking of little stuff to do and just start building them. So that's pretty much Lublogger's development cycle. And if you kind of go into the GitHub page, you can see that I have like a little announcement that says like I'm taking like a 6 month hiatus from May 1st to November 1st, because those are the warm months. And that's when I have a bunch of plans, you know, a bunch of stuff all planned out to do. Yeah, so that's pretty much Lublogger's development cycle. In the winter months, there's just nothing to do, lots of free time. And that's how I can spend like just pretty much every day building that app.
Yeah, that's great. It's funny. I was browsing social media today and I encountered another project who had posted, hey, we're taking a month break. We do this occasionally. It's really healthy for us. We're going to push pause on everything. You can keep using the software, continue submitting bugs and feature requests, but we're not going to have any activity and then we'll be back. And I think that's a really neat idea. Do you feel like you're leaving Lublogger in a good place as you get ready to embark on your 6 month hiatus?
I think it's pretty stable for now. I mean, I did resolve a pretty big bug with it just a couple of days ago, actually. And it was brought up by another Utah-based company that was trying to set up Lublogger, I believe. They were basically saying that the SMTP client wasn't able to send emails through ProtonMail. I did some research, I did some digging on it, and turns out the implementation that Microsoft provided was like really outdated, and even Microsoft won't recommend anyone to build using it. And they're like, hey, don't use the SMTP client that came with .NET, use Mailkit, which is this other project maintained by a third-party developer. I mean, I went to look at it, I installed it, I updated it, and turns out it was just the outdated library that Microsoft was providing. So in my opinion, it's pretty stable, you know, like I use it every day. So if there were like any like breaking changes or bugs, I will have like picked it up immediately, you know, so yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. Since launching it, have you had a lot of interest from other members in the community wanting to contribute to the code and development?
Contribute to the code, like the logic of the application itself? No, straight up, no, this is not a whole lot of people who are sending pull requests for features and stuff like that. But I did get a lot of help with setting up GitHub Actions and deployment, you know, automated deployment to the Docker Container Registry and the GitHub Container Registry and all of that stuff. I got a lot of help from that because I had no idea how to set up any of that. And people just flooded in, people with tons more experience with Docker and all of that automated deployment stuff just flooded in and just start submitting like Docker Compose files and all of this stuff. It was just great. But feature-wise, there just hasn't been much.
Are you saying they didn't teach you GitHub Actions in any of your accounting classes?
No, it's just not part of the subjects, unfortunately.
I think that leads me to a good point that I wanted to ask about earlier. How did you get into software development? So it sounds like you're in finance or accounting of some nature, or at least maybe that's where your background is. What prompted this?
I actually started writing programs and I guess just started developing software when I was like 11 or 12 years old. So it's about 15, 16 years ago. But it all really started with me just looking at like a few, you know, like those old DOS programs, which is like those command line interfaces. And I'm like, I wonder how they work. I just watched a few YouTube videos and just went from there. As I slowly got older, you know, like I didn't expect to be able to like make a career out of software engineering. And so when I went to college and stuff like that, I went with the second best thing that I like doing and I know I'm pretty good at, which is accounting. But in my third or fourth year of college, getting my accounting degree, I did an internship at a small regional firm. So it's not like a big four audit firm or anything, but I did an internship and in tax accounting. I mean, not tax accounting, but, you know, just preparing tax forms and filing W-2s for people and stuff like that.
Right.
And I think after like the first internship, I was just like, I can't do this for the rest of my life. It was pretty hard because I had to like switch majors. I didn't actually switch majors. I took on a second major. So I double majored in information systems, which is not quite computer science, but it's like if computer science was taught by a business college, you know?
Right, right.
And it was easy to pivot into because I already had a bunch of business acumen classes. And I took that one. Turns out I'm actually pretty good at writing software too, you know? Mm-hmm. And graduated, went to tech industry and just never look back. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you have an accounting degree, but it is one of two.
Yes.
And you've never used that in your professional career. Okay.
No. I've never used my accounting degree. I mean, I use it sometimes when I'm calculating mortgage interest rates and stuff like that, but, you know, yeah.
That's fair. Can you talk a little bit about with what I thought or had perceived was a non-technical background, how you had chosen what language to write LewBlogger in and what your development environment looks like. But even knowing you do have technical experience and background, I'm still interested in hearing how someone like you or a developer would sit down and say, okay, this is what I'm doing. Here's what I want to do. Here's what I think is the best way to do it and then just run with it.
LewBlogger is written primarily in C# for the back end and JavaScript in the front end. The reason why I chose this to tools, programming language, frameworks, whatever you call them. Honestly, it's just because I'm like super familiar with them. Like when I first started writing software, I was building everything in .NET framework. And I think over time, I just got super familiar with it. And even though I've picked up a bunch of other tools and skill sets in like the few years that I've been in the industry, I've wrote a few React apps, I've wrote a few Next.js apps and stuff like that. But it just, something just feels very familiar when it comes to C#. So that's how I chose it, you know, because I'm really familiar with it and I have a very good understanding of what the runtimes and the frameworks are doing in the background.
That sounds like a fair rationale to me. I spend a lot of time online and reading question and help posts from new users and trying to answer. And I feel like often what it reminds me of a question that pops up all the time and someone will almost inevitably always ask, what operating system should I use when for my self-hosting server? And the answer I like the most is whatever you're comfortable with. Because that's what you're going to be the most efficient with. You're going to get out there. You're going to start doing rather than spending all your time planning and troubleshooting and planning and troubleshooting. So just start with what you know and then maybe pivot later if you decide it wasn't the best option. I feel like for software like Lublogger, maybe it's not as easy to pivot and just switch to a different programming language. I think that does happen, but still, I think the sentiment is the same.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely what I was most comfortable with. So, yeah.
So in your, I guess 5 months now that Lublogger has been public, have you had any interesting or noteworthy interactions with any members of the community?
I want to say not really. I mean, in your previous interview with the guy behind Mealy, it's a lot of the same stuff. You know, some people are just making like feature requests, but you more or less know that they're not going to be using it 2 weeks down the road and stuff like that. There's a lot of feature requests, I think, in the open source space in general, where anyone can just make feature requests. And in my opinion, there's not a whole lot of too weird interactions and stuff like that. But one thing I did notice that was a little different in all these years of, being in the tech industry is that there's almost like this instant gratification thing that is just plaguing the open source community in general. And it's mainly due to all these AI models that people are popping out nowadays. They are claiming to be able to like build entire programs and stuff like that just from prompts.
Right.
You know? And I think a lot of users who are not super technical, who don't understand how software development life cycles work in general, they just kind of look at what Devin AI is doing and they'll go and make requests to the developers of the apps they're using, and they'll expect that, it's something that developer can just plug into AI and just generate code for them. That is something that I did notice quite a bit in this past few months. And it was just never a thing before all these AI large language models and stuff like that were in place.
Right. So it's not as much like a sense of entitlement as it is just not understanding maybe what they're asking for or the scale of what they might be asking about?
Pretty much. I get quite a few feature requests and stuff like that that I know it's probably going to benefit a lot of people. And, I know it's going to take a huge time to make, but to develop, but people are just expecting it to be done in such a short and unrealistic time frame.
Do you have personal goals for when you receive feature requests or bug reports? Do they haunt you for the first 24 hours until you're able to respond to them? Or are you generally pretty relaxed and able to get to them when you feel like you can?
I feel like that was that's how I am with every new open source project I start. Because truth be told, Lublogger is not my first open source project. I have had quite a few open source projects in the past, but just none of them have ever quite attained the success of Lublogger. But I feel like I do that, every time there's a new email that comes into my inbox and it says feature request or bug report from GitHub, and my heart just skips a little bit. I did read a really good quote recently on the open source subreddit, and it was someone who was kind of being burnt out by all of this feature requests that were coming in, and someone told this guy, your inbox is not your to-do list. I think that was such a great quote and such a great phrase. And
yeah,
the moment I read that, it's just completely changed the way I see incoming emails and stuff like that. So nowadays when I see it, I'll just look at it, I'm like, yeah, this seems feasible, or nah, this is not gonna happen, and I would just close it as not planned. I feel like I'm a lot more manage and calm now when it comes to feature requests and whatnot. So yeah.
And I think that's fair. I can think of a number of projects that just don't accept feature requests at all. They say, this is a hobby project for me, or comfortable with where this is, and we're just not accepting feature requests. And you have to be okay with that, which I think most people are, because we're getting the software for free in most cases.
I mean, I've also seen a few projects where they go into a paid-only support model. If you want to request a feature, you have to pay them a certain amount of money for them to even look at your request. I see that quite, I'm seeing that quite a bit more nowadays. Or some people would just put up a banner and just say, it's, this is feature complete. I'm not taking any more requests.
Yep. Yeah. And I think that's completely fair. Slightly unrelated question. Did you use AI for the Lublogger logo as well? Or did you create that yourself?
No, I put that up myself in like 2 minutes in like Paint. It was really bad. I used Paint for that.
Wow, not even. I was expecting Photoshop or Illustrator or something, but no MS Paint.
MS Paint.
Oh, that's impressive then.
Yeah, I mean, all I had to do was set the impact font and just made it italic and just write it out.
I hadn't even noticed that, but I'm looking at it now and I completely see it.
Yeah. Basically, for the shadow, like you can see like a small bit of shadow behind the words. I just started it with the black tags and then switch it to yellow and just put it on top of it and just be like, good enough.
I love it. And you don't need more than that. It's sufficient. I like the gear icon. It conveys what the purpose of the application is, and that's what you need.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. Although I do regret not making it a larger size when I first started it, because now people are asking if they could like put stickers of it on their cars and stuff. And I'm like, I don't have a big enough like image for you to use. Sorry.
That's amazing, actually. People are asking for Lublogger merch and everything already.
I know. It is kind of surprising to me, too. I was like, why would you put this on your car? But, you know. I think what happened was basically there were a few car clubs that started hosting their own instance of Lublogger. Like I know out on the East Coast, there's one that's like a DeLorean Car Owners Association or something in the DMV region. And, you know, they were pretty happy with Lublogger. And I believe down in Moab, which is just a couple hours south of where I live, there's like a Jeep club that's starting to do the same thing as well. So, yeah.
I hadn't considered that. I feel like merch maybe might be a good way to help fund some of the time and effort you put into the project. I know we'll talk a little bit or maybe not even talk about it. I'll just share some of your donation links in the show notes for anyone who's listening and would like to contribute to the work and the effort you've put into Lublogger. Stickers and shirts might not be a bad avenue for something like that.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it's a bad avenue, but I don't want to, you know, be stuck running a merch shop and like, you know, be busy like shipping it out to people and stuff. Like, so one thing I'll probably do is I asked my girlfriend to help me like, you know, make like a higher res version of the logo. And what I'm just going to do is just put it up on the documentation website and people can just print it off themselves and, you know, do whatever they want with it. So yeah.
Yeah, that's a great idea. That's a great idea. I know that I've looked into e-commerce before and that's a little bit of a beast. The self-host, especially managing hosted is a beast, let alone trying to self-host it. Curious to hear a little bit about what your home lab looks like. If you have something beyond just Lublogger and some of the open source projects you've written, if you don't mind talking a little bit about any hardware you have and maybe some of the software you've deployed and maybe what a couple of your favorite applications are.
Obviously you've heard about the ARR suites and you know what they're for. Like, you know what Plex is for.
Mm-hmm. I have no idea what you're talking about.
If we can neither confirm nor deny. But a lot of my home lab setup, which I used to have and I used to maintain religiously, and nowadays I just kind of gave up on it, was just ran off like this 15-year-old laptop that put me through college. It was this crazy old laptop. It had paint on it, you know. I mean, like physical paint that was just spilled on the cover itself. And, you know, we've spilled a bunch of stuff on it, but it was an old crappy laptop with like dried age plastic casings and whatever. And it used to just sit right under my TV and just hooked up to an HDMI cable and an Ethernet cable. And it will run whatever I wanted to run. So, yeah.
Do you keep the battery in? I hear people talk about using laptops a lot. And I feel like every old laptop in my life that I've had that I could have recycled via server or some sort of home lab equipment, the battery would explode after keeping it plugged in for even longer than maybe 48 hours.
Well, mine doesn't explode getting plugged in that long, but when I was running it as a home lab, what I had was I had a UPS, like an interruptible power supply, hooked up to it, and then have that hooked up to the laptop with the battery removed. So in case of power outage or, you know, just a little fluke in the power or whatever, it will just turn off completely. It will run off the UPS until the power comes back. So,
gotcha. That's fascinating. And you're still using that laptop today, or you've since upgraded?
No, I am still using the laptop. I actually use it to compile LoopLogger. That's what LoopLogger is built on.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. That thing, it would take a full minute to compile LoopLogger, but it will compile and it will run.
That is fascinating and surprising to me. I am not a technical person by profession. I am through hobby. And so sometimes when I have these conversations, I'm a little intimidated. I'm thinking, oh, you know, people who are developing and doing all sorts of other stuff with software probably have these insane setups at home and, you know, like enterprise level setups where they have things going on. So it's really interesting to hear that's what you're running. I'm also impressed with what you do with your laptop, and that's actually probably a little more intimidating itself.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I get where the preconceived notion is because where, you know, like professional developers have very professional, very high-end setup and stuff like that. I mean, for my actual job, because I am employed full-time outside of LoopLogger, I don't do LoopLogger full-time, unfortunately. I am given like a fairly powerful laptop to build all kinds of apps. But then again, those apps are like way more resource intensive, you know. LoopLogger, with the way it's written and stuff like that, it will actually run on 200 megs of RAM.
Wow.
Yeah, it is. It is very, very efficient. I think it's just because of the way it's written. Like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Electron apps.
I've heard of it, but I wouldn't be able to talk to them in any capacity.
It's just that a lot of the more modern frameworks, I want to say. So like LoopLogger is written in .NET 8, and .NET 8 is actually a really, really efficient framework. Like, you can run this standalone cross-platform, you know, run on Windows, Mac, whatever, and it will run, it will be very resource cheap, I say, because it's, I'm not sure if that's the right phrases to say, to use, but it doesn't take up a lot of resources. But you have Electron apps, which are like, imagine a web server bundled with a Chrome web, like a Google Chrome browser, and it just displays one app, and those apps, they just take up so much power. So I think it really depends on what you're developing. If I'm just developing purely in .NET, I could just build off a 15-year-old laptop and be totally happy with it. So yeah.
Wow. You said something interesting there about how you do have a full-time job outside of LoopLogger and you don't do it full-time. Do you hope to maybe one day do something like develop projects like LoopLogger full-time, or is that a hobby that you're happy keeping as your hobby?
Well, I think it would be great to do open source projects full-time, but where I'm currently employed, you know, the work that I do is also like pretty important. I also get a lot of like gratification from just doing my full-time employment. So I'm not super sure if the opportunity ever arises and someone offers me like a full-time contract to do LoopLogger, I won't say that I won't take it, because the incentive is always there. But I also feel like if I take that opportunity and I work on this full-time and I start treating it like a job, I'm going to be kind of focused on revenue generation and all of that stuff. I'll have stakeholders to answer for, and it will almost take away certain control I have from LoopLogger, because now I'm just an employee of, you know, whoever the highest bidder is, and I don't think I want to do that. I think I'm pretty happy keeping LoopLogger in its current stage, where it makes like a small amount of money, where I can like afford like a nice meal once a month. But I don't think I would do it full time, because I feel like if I do it full time, I would start to resent it. So yeah.
Yeah, that's completely fair. But you enjoy it well enough that you do something similar full time and then also come home and do it in your spare time or occasionally. I know that seems to be a point of contention for a lot of people, where I have coworkers who will talk about, hey, I work in IS in some capacity. I do that for a living, 40, 50 hours a week. I don't want to come home and worry about that when I'm at home.
I think that's like a, I mean, you know, like I myself have spoken to a lot of mechanics who, you know, after a whole day of working on other people's cars, the last thing they want to do is work on their cars, you know, and so,
yeah.
But I just love writing software so much, you know, I love solving the challenges that different people faces and stuff like that. And so I couldn't do that on my day job too. But, you know, obviously in my day job, a lot of those challenges and stuff like that are vetted through like a whole group of product owners and managers and stuff like that. But in LeoBlogger, I get a more direct interaction with like my user base. And it's just really interesting to see what kind of challenges they're facing. And I, you know, I just view them as puzzles and I just like solving them. So yeah.
Oh, that's great. I know we talked a little bit about your logo already. Do you enjoy the graphic design aspect of developing LeoBlogger as much as you do writing the source code for it?
Primarily, I just draw a lot of inspiration for the interface from Netflix and apps that emulate Netflix without name dropping any of them.
Yeah. Again, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah. So you can kind of see that on the LeoBlogger in the garage view, you know, you have your cars as your, like your tiles and it has like a picture and stuff like that. Honestly, I draw a lot of inspiration from video streaming apps. So yeah, as for how much I enjoy doing it, actually, quite a bit. On my job, for my employment, I do a lot of front-end development work. And so I'm like very comfortable with CSS and all of that stuff. And so, yeah.
I've read about there's a psychological component to designing software and knowing where to put things and where people's eyes will be drawn to. Are you in tune with that, do you feel like? And is there an element of that in LeoBlogger?
No, I mean... like there are some stuff that now that I look back at it, I feel like could have been placed better or designed better. The UX, the user experience component of LeoBlogger could definitely use a lot more help, because a lot of the times when I build it, I just kind of go, hey, this seems like this would be a good place, and I just put it in there, and I didn't actually have like a group of test users that I can consult with, so that's just kind of where it stuck. And the thinking of it was that people will get used to it eventually, but the hard part of it was that once people get used to it and you think of a better way of doing it and you implement that, that's when people are going to start complaining because they're used to some things being in certain places and stuff like that. And now it's different, even though, you know, people's eyes would look for, basically they would, seasoned users will look for different buttons and different fields in specific locations. And so now I'm just kind of locked in a spot where I just can't really change or update anything anymore. So yeah.
Right. I feel like you have to find the balance between executing and providing functionality and not delaying or wasting time on trying to make sure it's all perfectly placed or properly placed within the interface. So I can respect the fact that, you know, at some point you probably value delivering things in a timely manner, maybe more so than making them as efficient or optimized as possible from that perspective.
In my day job, where I build a lot of front-facing, like user-facing apps and stuff like that, so I more or less have kind of like a mental template to work on. You know, like I know like where to put the logout button at the very least, so, and all that stuff. So yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. When you were talking about designing LeoBlogger after Netflix and similar software, are you talking about the garage page where you see a photo of the car and just like brief information? Is that like the poster equivalent of what you would see?
Pretty much. Yeah.
From a media streaming site. That's incredible. That's an interesting tidbit of information. I'm never going to look at that garage page the same way again. So outside of software development, so you do it for a living and you also do it as a hobby. Do you have any other hobbies outside of work that you find yourself doing often that you're willing to share?
I work on cars, so yeah. I mean, that's pretty much where LeoBlogger comes from. You know, I've got way too many project vehicles for a single person. So, yeah.
How many do you have?
Oh, man. So, I have the 92 Jeep Cherokee, and I also have like a 97 Nissan Maxima. Eventually, I'll be helping my girlfriend out with her 1982 GMC pickup. So, yeah. In terms of other hobbies, I guess I like visiting national parks. I'm about halfway through visiting all of the American ones. So, yeah.
Oh, wow. You're in a great spot for it if you live in Utah in the Midwest, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
You could probably hit most of those there. So, Ivan, I want to pivot a little bit. A question I like to ask everyone as I interview them is always, do you have any hot takes about either the self-hosted or open source community? a hot take being, do you have any opinions, usually strong opinions, that seem to differ from the majority of other people in the community?
I want to say that when large language models and AIs and all this stuff started coming out, there was just this huge trend, or I guess huge wave of developers just kind of hopping on the bandwagon and just chasing, you know, like AI and LLMs and all this stuff. And all of a sudden you just have like a million alternatives, like, you know, alternative LLMs that you can self-host on your server, right?
Sure.
But one of my hot take about that is that I feel like a lot of developers, a lot of really skilled, really talented people, they're just so busy chasing trends that they're ignoring problems that actual people actually need.
Oh, and interesting.
This is kind of like a segue back to LeapLogger, but you know, like you look at LeapLogger, for example, it's not built specifically for tech enthusiasts. It's not specifically built for anything. It can be built for car enthusiasts, but it can also be, you know, just your neighbor who lives working on his car down the street. If more talented, skilled developers just kind of talk to the people that they work with or the people that lives around them and lives in their community, I think they will find that there's a lot of opportunities and great ideas for software that will greatly benefit a lot of people instead of just going on Reddit or going to Hacker News and seeing what the latest thing is and how you can make a copy of it, I guess.
It's funny, in a way, I don't blame them. Not to say, I don't disagree with you. I don't blame them, because I feel like the problem with open source is, where do you get funding from? And that's at the forefront of a lot of developers' minds. And so chasing the trends, I think, often ends up being a decent way to secure and procure more funding, or maybe just set yourself up for it better. But I hear what you're saying. I absolutely do. And I think it's a fair point.
I mean, I guess this can almost segue into the end game for LeapLogger, because...
Yeah. So what is your goal for LeapLogger?
I mean, right now, we do make some money from it, but I don't really know. I think eventually it's going to get to a point where it's so feature complete, I would just have, like, just ran enough attention and energy to work on it, I would just end up passing it on to someone else. Or if a corporation comes in and say they want to take over maintenance duties from me, that's... You know, that would be something to consider down the road. But I think it's fine. I don't think I'm going to pursue a model where, you know, I mean, I don't know if you heard about what Image did today.
I was going to ask you about that, actually. For those listening, we are recording this on Wednesday, May 1st. And just earlier today, the Image Photo Project announced they have funding from an organization that sounds like they back open source self-hosted projects. And so now they have financial support to go full time while still kind of maintaining oversight and, you know, direction of the project.
Futo, I believe, was the company that backed them.
Yeah, were you familiar with them before?
I've heard about them through a Louis Roseman video where he was kind of talking about like his YouTube clone. It was backed by Futo. I don't think I like the idea that, you know, LeapLogger would ever be backed by like a venture capitalist firm, you know, because every business intention, like, you know, it's to make money, right? Like, that's how businesses work most of the time, is that you gotta have some kind of revenue generation methods and some kind of business model that will allow it to sustain itself. Where I see LeapLogger going, or I guess kind of the end game of it, is that I have been in talks with a certain Utah company based in Ogden, and I was just pitching this idea to the guy, and he runs kind of like a managed self-hosting thing. He just helps like other smaller companies spin up their own self-hosted instances of apps and all of that stuff. I've been in talks with him and saying, you know, like just kind of talk about maybe offering LeapLogger as a service that he can spin up for his users and his clients. Yeah. And yeah, for workshops or all kinds of stuff, really. So I think that's where LeapLogger is going to end up eventually. So, I mean, with that model, I still have full control over the application. It's just offered to different people. So there's still going to be widespread adoption of it, basically.
Have you considered, and I know I'll probably be crucified for this, but have you considered putting certain features behind a paywall or something to help fund parts of the project?
What you're basically suggesting is an open core model, right?
So yeah, and I'm not necessarily suggesting it. I'm just asking if you've ever considered it.
To that, I would say no, really, because I feel like the moment I start limiting features to like certain features to like paid users versus like non-paid users and all of that stuff, it's the moment I'm going to start chasing for, you know, paid users.
Right.
Does that make sense? Because it's like, that's the one thing I really dislike about open core applications in general, is that if you're using the free version of something, you're going to, different users are going to see different features as a requirement or not a requirement, like it's optional or stuff like that. But the developers who have an incentive of making money, they're going to know that if they just offer like 90% of what the user wants and the 10% which they really need behind the paywall, they can make more money that way. I feel like if I embrace the open core model, then it's going to, then comes the question of how do I decide what stays free and what stays behind the paywall? I really don't think that that will benefit the majority of the user base at that point. So yeah.
I appreciate your focus on the user base versus anything else, and I admire that for sure, but I certainly understand why some projects have to pursue that. You know, some of these projects have entire teams of people that need to be funded or need to be compensated for the time they're putting in. So when I feature things, I don't discriminate between is something a paid features or not, because at the end of the day, it's all enablement through self-hosting. But, you know, I tend to lean a little bit more towards projects like yours that you don't run into things like that with.
The company that I work for, we have licensed stuff from Adobe. And that was just the one thing that I really hated about licensing stuff from Adobe in general, is because you would license one thing from them and you would think that it will include everything. But then when you really need that one thing, they're like, Adobe's going to come back and be like, hey, that's an extra $1,000 a year per user, per machine. So yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that is just one of those things that just felt like wasn't quite right to me. So, yeah, but I totally understand open source funding needs to, there's a long road ahead of it to, you know, sustainable open source funding. So,
yeah, absolutely. It's funny, I was going back to the image conversation. I was looking up the organization because I wasn't familiar with them. And I didn't even get the impression that they were a venture capitalist firm or anything. Seems like it's a billionaire-backed organization that legitimately just goes around and funds these projects. So it was interesting online. I was both on Mastodon and on Reddit reading and seeing how people were reacting to this and watching and digesting the speculation as to, oh, you know, the money has to come from somewhere at some point. You know, there's got to be give and take. Where is that going to be? But I have to say, on the surface, it sounds promising. I'm happy for the Image team, and I hope it ends up being good for them.
Alex Tran, the guy who's behind Image, like, you know, I've seen this guy, I've seen all of his work in the past few years, and I really think he, you know, I'm just really happy for them that they got finally some kind of funding, and they were allowed to focus on Image full time. But I believe if you kind of look into like the terms, I mean, I'm not super worried about where the money is coming from with, you know, companies and corporations like Futo and stuff like that. But I think the one thing that really caught people's eye was the company now owns all of Image's brands and trademarks and IP, basically, of the intellectual property. And I think that's something that people are particularly concerned about, because if you own the IP, then you basically steer where the project is going to go.
Yep, that's fair. That's a fair concern. I guess only time will tell.
If they choose to come out with a paid version a few years from now, like there's really nothing anyone can do about it. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. Although, couldn't they theoretically just fork the project and take it a different direction with different people?
You could, yeah. But I mean, forking projects, I mean, that's just another can of worms, right? Like open source software, you fork a project, who's going to maintain it?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't mean to make that sound easier than it is.
No, you're good. You're good.
Just wanted to make sure. I just wanted to confirm it was an option if it ever comes to that, because Image has a large following.
Oh yeah, I mean, it totally is an option, but it also really depends on the person who's forking it. I think, I can't remember what was that project that was forked into OpenTofu. I believe it was Terraform. They used to be open source, kind of like Image, and they went to a source available license, or I think they went closed source, I'm not super sure, but I believe the Linux Foundation forked it, and now they're maintaining just a fork of it that is still open source and stuff like that. But I think the biggest problem with forking software is that it's going to be a constant catch-up with the people who originally built it versus the people who are now responsible for maintaining it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. When we sign off here, I'm going to go fork Lou Blogger. and not maintain it just for the sake of this conversation.
I mean, a lot of people already do that. There's a lot of people who fork Lublogger and they just, you know, they just put it up there. They're just like, I'm forking this project because I want to keep a copy of this at this time.
Oh, that's interesting. I was just going to ask you why people do that. And that's what it is. There's no other way to get it, to get a snapshot of it at that point in time.
I mean, you can clone the repository at that point in time. But, you know, then when I push like new changes and stuff like that, it's gonna tell you that your branch is outdated and all that stuff. So I don't think people really care about that stuff. But if you fork it, you basically preserve a copy of it right at the time. It doesn't care about any downstream or upstream changes. So
that's fair. That's interesting. That's a whole other side of open source software that I've never been exposed to, I guess.
I've had experience forking software before. One of the employers that I used to work for, they fork Keycloak, and what a mistake that was.
Yeah, no kidding. I feel like if you're forking a project, something like that is not the one you want to fork, a security-minded and focused piece of software.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure I've posted this on a Reddit comment somewhere before, but the employer basically forked Keycloak because we wanted a certain different feature set, you know, with like how it handles user tokens and stuff like that. And they spent a whole year, they hired a bunch of developers to work on it to build that feature out. And in the end, we just contacted the Keycloak team and flew them out. Just paid them to do it for us.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. But I mean, forking open source software, like anyone can fork a repository, but maintaining it and keeping up with requests, you know, and stuff like that, I think that's the hardest part, because the larger a piece of software is, like Lublogger itself is pretty simple, I want to say, you know, a handful of files, not a whole lot of logic. But like larger apps, they get significantly more complex to build. And, you know, I mean, this is going to be like a developer's hot take, but I feel like a lot of developers, they write like indecipherable code in the name of job security.
That is interesting. I've never heard that before.
Yeah. So like, you know, the harder your code is to maintain, the less they can fire you, because they can't find someone who replaces you who understands your code that you wrote. So, I mean, I'm not saying that that happens to all of the projects, all of the open source projects, but I feel like that's definitely true for quite a bit of projects, especially the really large and complex ones. FFmpeg is open source and people complain about what a mess its code base is all the time.
I didn't realize that. I wasn't aware of that. I'm familiar with it, but I've never seen people talk about it in that capacity.
Yeah.
Ivan, I think that we're about at time. So thank you again so much for joining. It's been great talking about Lublogger and a little bit about yourself and kind of the things that drive your decisions and some of your hobbies. So I appreciate you joining me today. Any lasting thoughts you want to leave before we sign off?
No, it's just great to be here and just great to share a word about Lublogger and stuff. So yeah.
Yeah, sounds great. I will throw some links in the episode notes to Lublogger and to your GitHub repository, as well as some of your sponsor links for anyone who wants to donate and contribute towards the work and great, you know, the great work you've done so far with Lublogger and all of your other open source projects, even if they might not have been as successful. But it's been great. I look forward to seeing more Lublogger releases after your 6-month hiatus and wish you the best of luck. And for everyone else, thanks for listening and happy self-hosting.
Bye.